Case number 08-5467 et al. National Postal Mail Handlers Union, a division of the Laborers International Union of North America, appellant, versus American Postal Workers Union et al. Mr. Donahue for the appellant, USPS, Ms. Ravagering for appellant, National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and Mr. Haidar for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Ray Donahue, Special Assistant United States Attorney on behalf of the Postal Service. It's my intention to use my full 10 minutes, and then counsel for the mail handlers will be reserving 3 of her minutes for a rebuttal. The agreement in this case, Your Honors, plainly states that all local craft jurisdictional assignments, which are not already the subject of a pending locally initiated grievance, will be deemed a proper assignment for that facility. The parties agree that the meaning of that provision is that all work assignments made prior to April 1992 are essentially frozen in time and no longer subject to dispute. The only way that a work assignment continues to be subject to dispute is if something changed. In other words, there is new or consolidated facilities, new work, or an operational change. The parties agree that none of those conditions to arbitrability are present in this case. That being the case, the dispute was specifically not arbitrable under the terms of the agreement.
Under the terms of the agreement, isn't the question of whether the dispute is arbitrable itself arbitrable? The question of whether this is something that's properly before the arbitrator, isn't that issue subject to arbitration?
It's not clear from the record, Your Honor, whether that particular issue of arbitrability was designated to the arbitrator in this case.
What do you mean it's not clear from the record?
I'm looking at JA 108 and 109, the language of the Q&A R1399, and it sure
That's correct, Your Honor.
Part of the agreement was if we have a dispute over whether an issue is subject to arbitration, that question itself goes to arbitration, right?
That's correct.
And that's what happened here. It went to the arbitrator.
That's correct.
And he made a decision that you disagree with. But our standard under this is quite lenient, isn't it? I mean, errant findings of fact, errant conclusions of law, provided the arbitrator's decision draws its essence from the agreement, that's the end of the inquiry,
well,
right?
Well, it's not the end of the inquiry, but that's certainly true, Your Honor, that particular dispute itself, if you take what the Q&A says as Your Honor just cited.
So you concede that this was a dispute, the question of whether
over
this is arbitrable.
That's correct.
Was properly before the arbitrator.
That it was before the arbitrator, yes. The only issue then is
was
that...
Was it properly before the arbitrator? You left out the word properly there.
Yes,
I just want to make sure.
Okay. Properly before the arbitrator. I think that's fair to say. The only thing is that does not automatically mean that we defer to the arbitrator's finding. What it means is that the arbitrator's finding must be upheld so long as it draws its essence from the agreement. And that's where the arbitrator's award falls short in this case. If the arbitrator would have interpreted this to be some sort of operational change, even if he had been wrong, the court would have to defer to that determination, even if all of the parties disagreed with it. And it wouldn't be subject to review by this court and certainly should be affirmed under the Steelworkers Trilogy. The issue in this case is that the arbitrator didn't interpret any of those provisions that lead to his ability to resolve the dispute. He simply found that based on the party's scheduling letter, which really did nothing more than set a date and time for the arbitration, that the parties somehow had mutually agreed that he should decide the dispute.
The arbitrator did more than that. That was, if you look at the JA 183, that's true if it's just that paragraph. But then in the alternative, the arbitrator relies on a continuing violation theory. And that may be poor reasoning, bad decision making, et cetera, but that's deciding the question, as Judge Griffith said, that's deciding the question of arbitrability there.
Well, I would take exception with that, Your Honor. I think there needs to be a distinction made between timeliness and arbitrability. As the APW sets forth in its brief, there are two avenues on which the APW believes that the dispute can be deemed arbitrable, either when it involves new work or whether it could have been brought beforehand. The first problem with that argument, Your Honor, is that it's specifically contrary to the terms of the agreement. The agreement says, first, Your Honor, that all local craft jurisdictional assignments will be deemed proper, And it also states that no other grievances will be brought over existing work assignments. And that captures the party's agreement that if there wasn't a pending grievance at the time, at April 1992, no new disputes would be brought. So the fact that the arbitrator may have relied on timeliness doesn't in itself, it's contrary to the agreement for him to find a continuing violation because it would effectively eviscerate the agreement.
The district judge said that he agreed with you that the arbitrator was wrong. Arbitrators, courts are wrong, arbitrators are wrong, but we have a very deferential standard here.
We do, Your Honor, and really the only thing that the arbitrator is required to do is to in some way rest his decision on a construction of the agreement. If he had done that in this case, if he had said, here is X provision,
well,
I believe it means
this. It's a theory of interpreting the agreement that you may not disagree with. Courts interpret statutes sometimes in a way that are inconsistent with the plain terms of a statute based on various theories of construction. That seems to be what happened here. It may be a bad theory of construction, but it was a theory of construction.
Well, and to understand why the timeliness is not an access point to arbitrability, Your Honor, I think I need to explain, if I could have a moment, to kind of how the agreement came to be, and I won't take too much of the court's time. Before April 1992, there was no tripartite process. What was happening was that the APW was bringing grievances under its own collective bargaining agreement with the Postal Service, and the mail handlers were doing the same thing. These disputes were being settled bilaterally. So to say that the fact that a grievance could have been brought doesn't somehow bring it to a process that didn't even exist before April 1992. At best, what the continuing violation theory would do would be to say, we know you didn't have a grievance pending prior to April 1992, but to the extent you say you could have, and we're going to find a continuing violation theory, it might grandfather it into the prior process, but it doesn't bring it within the purview of the tripartite process, which didn't even exist until the parties agreed to it in April 1992. The only avenue in which arbitrability can be found in this case is if it involves new work. And the parties all agree, and the arbitrator didn't find otherwise, that no new work is involved in this particular case. And where that particular provision, which is really the threshold issue of arbitrability, was not decided by the arbitrator, he didn't purport to interpret it. The APW doesn't even argue that new work existed in this case. The arbitrator's award cannot be said to draw its essence from the agreement.
But isn't there a provision of the contract that says when the regional dispute resolution committee meets that it must decide things by consensus? Everyone's in agreement. And isn't the arbitrator's theory here that the RDRC, in fact, agreed that this would be arbitrable? You can dispute whether that's accurate.
Sure.
Probably is not accurate. But isn't that an interpretation of the contract? He's looking at the contract. He says, contract says you have to do things by agreement. They've done it by agreement.
Why is that not
drawing its essence, wrongly perhaps, but drawing its essence from the contract?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, and for this reason. The agreement very plainly sets forth that one party can unilaterally move the dispute from the dispute resolution committee to arbitration. And in fact, that's exactly what happened here. The APW specifically said, we want to move this to arbitration. The other two parties didn't agree, but they moved it. Then the only thing that the parties set forth in the scheduling letter was, look, we're obligated by the agreement to show
that. All I'm getting at is this. It seems to me the central question for us is we have to look at the arbitrator's award and see if it draws its essence from the contract. And as you've acknowledged, that's a very deferential standard. And I'm just putting out for your consideration your response. Wasn't he, in fact, doing that when he looked at the provision of the agreement that said the RDRC must decide things collectively? And the theory here is that they collectively decided to arbitrate this dispute in the face of language in the contract that would suggest otherwise. In fact, they amended the collective bargaining agreement.
I don't think it is, Your Honor, simply because I don't see in the agreement where he's relying on what the RDRC did. In terms of,
I thought throughout he's talking about the mutual agreement of
right.
all the parties.
And I think in that sense, Your Honor, I think he's talking simply about the scheduling letter, which in regards to this case simply was the time and place of the agreement. It didn't tee up in particular any particular issue for him.
He didn't agree to arbitrability, just said something's going to happen, this is when and where it's going to happen.
Correct. And at that point, the Postal Service had two choices. Either because it didn't believe its dispute was arbitrable, it could have shown up and said nothing, Or it could have said, arbitrator, this matter is not properly before you because it doesn't involve new work.
That's what they said.
And that's exactly what they said, Your Honor, both in the RDRC process and also in the arbitration. It specifically said that one of these conditions to arbitrability has to be met. It hasn't been met in this case. Therefore, the arbitrator can't reach the merits of the award. And if the arbitrator would have said, I know it says that, but I'm qualifying and I'm relying on something else, then this court has held that the arbitrator can rely on other provisions at the expense of others. Where the arbitrator does not even purport to interpret the threshold issue.
He doesn't have to cite it, does he? I mean, are you saying he has to make reference to the contract itself? Or?
No, Your Honor, but to the extent that his award is entitled deference, there has to be a nexus between the terms of the agreement and his interpretation. For example, in the APWU case that I know this court just recently decided, the issue in that case was whether the employee was properly separated. Now, in terms of interpreting what separation means, the arbitrator can look to outside sources outside the agreement to figure out what that means. If the arbitrator in this case would have said, I think this is an operational change, and had gone to outside sources to determine what that meant, that would be okay. The problem the arbitrator has here is that he hasn't tied it back to the specific terms of the agreement. There has to be a nexus between his finding of arbitrability and the specific conditions to arbitrability in the agreement. And without that nexus, his award isn't entitled
isn't
any deference.
The arbitrator's theory that the agreement incorporates a continuing violation theory implicitly?
Again, Your Honor, and I realize I'm out of time, so I'm happy
to. As long as you're answering questions.
Sure.
Those lights just control counsel. But.
Okay. That's really, Your Honor, the distinction that has to be made, I think, between timeliness and arbitrability. The argument could be made that it makes the access to the arbitration mechanism timely. It doesn't mean it's arbitrable. The only way it's the Postal Service position, the only way the dispute is arbitrable is if it involves new work. As I mentioned before, Your Honor, to the extent that a continuing violation theory would be accepted in this case, it wouldn't somehow thrust it into a procedure that didn't even exist prior to 1992. It would simply grandfather it into an old system that no longer exists. Now, of course, the Postal Service believes it'd be successful in fending off any sort of grievance in that old procedure as well. But simply because the APW believes it's not fair that they have a remedy, that they don't have a remedy either through the tripartite process or may lose through the old Article 15 process, doesn't mean that they have a permissible route to the agreement because...
I think Judge Kavanaugh is satisfied that you've answered your question. therefore, your time is up, and we will hear from the union.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The first union, not the second union. They're double teaming you this time, counsel. I know you're used to being the union, but you're one of the unions this time.
Good morning, Your Honors. Ramya Ravindran on behalf of the appellant, the National Postal Mail Handlers Union. I want to start with the first question that Judge Griffith posed to counsel for the Postal Service, and that's whether the question of whether this grievance was timely and properly filed under the party's agreement, the MOU, was put forth to the arbitrator. Yes, it was. But where I disagree with the way that Judge Griffith framed the question is that the arbitrator didn't actually make that finding here. It is common ground among the parties that under the MOU, the arbitrator has to make that threshold finding as to whether...
I don't understand
specifically which threshold finding.
Threshold finding as to whether a grievance that here undisputed filed after April of 1992 falls within one of the exceptions in the MOU that allows it to be brought in arbitration. And
new work.
The three exceptions of new work and new or consolidated facility or an operational change. And here the arbitrator did not make that finding here. Instead,
he has a section in the opinion on JA 183 to 184 entitled arbitrability. And then after that turns to the merits. And in the section on arbitrability, I think he sets forth fairly your position on this issue and then rejects it. So I don't think it's fair to say the arbitrator didn't address your argument or resolve it.
I agree with Your Honor that on page 184 he makes a reference to the continuing violation doctrine and cites a treatise for that doctrine. But the arbitration award has to be read as a whole. I'm sorry.
Isn't your position set forth fairly on page 183 before he resolves it, where it says employer and MPMHU position?
He does, and then what he goes on to find is that he says that if you look at the bottom of page 183, where on his findings, his finding is that the three parties mutually decided to seek third-party neutral guidance as to the future of this dispute.
Right. If it ended there, I think you'd have a pretty strong argument, but then you have the next alternative.
Right, and that's what I wanted to get to, Your Honor, is that there is a reference on page 4 of the award, which is page 184 of the joint appendix, where he makes a reference to the continuing violation doctrine, and he cites the labor arbitration treatise on that. But then, after he goes through the merits, he comes back to this question on page 9 of his award, and that's page 189 of the joint appendix, where he is once again addressing this question of whether or not he has the authority to reach the merits of the APWU's grievance here. And what he sets forth here effectively rescinds any notion of a continuing violation doctrine. If you look at page 9 of his award, the first thing he does is quotes the relevant portion of the MOU that says no new disputes will be initiated with respect to an existing work assignment. He's referencing the specific provision of the MOU that renders the APWU's grievance here improper and untimely. And then he goes on to say he recognizes the import of that language when he goes on in that paragraph to say that the language clearly points in the direction of limiting the filing of grievances, and then says, but the parties, quote, nonetheless agreed to seek clarification of this dispute in the RI 399 process. So what he's doing here is reaffirming his finding there was a mutual agreement by the parties.
The sentence before that, he uses the word principally. Principally because the parties mutually agreed. The word principally there would seem to recognize that he also had an alternative reason for finding arbitrability, namely the continuing violation theory.
But I believe that the reading the rest of that paragraph shows that that's not the case.
He
because
he doesn't qualify it in the next sentence.
In the next paragraph, and where he closes is he would be playing God if he were to void what he believes was this mutual agreement of the parties to waive the contractual provision regarding the threshold finding, and he could proceed directly to the merits. And I want to add, however, and just to not to repeat what counsel has already stated, but even if this court were to find that this continuing violation doctrine was actually the basis of the arbitrator's decision that he had the authority to reach the merits, this award is still due to be vacated.
Even if we assume that is correct, that it was the basis, does that continuing violation doctrine get around the three conditions of arbitrability?
It does not, Your Honor. And ultimately, as counsel has already stated, for an arbitration award to be upheld, it has to draw its essence from the party's contract. And that's the fundamental principle of arbitration, that arbitration is a matter of contract, and it's up to the parties to define and decide what the arbitrator gets to decide. And the arbitrator has to be construing that contract, and any finding that doesn't draw its essence from that contract can't be upheld. As the arbitrator himself recognized at page 9, the clear language of the MOU does not allow for any continuing violation notion. As of April 1992, any work assignment that was in place as of that time is deemed to be the proper assignment. So if the Postal Service continues to assign work on that basis after April of 1992, it can't violate, much less continuously violate, any provision because under the terms as all three parties have agreed.
Or if it does so, it's not arbitrable because it doesn't fit.
That's correct.
That provision, it doesn't fit.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I don't want to belabor any points that have already been addressed by counsel for the Postal Service, so unless the panel has further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, seeing none, we'll let you hold your time for rebuttal, and we'll hear from the other union.
May it please the Court, Anton Hajar for the American Postal Workers Union. Let me start out by saying that the Memorandum of Understanding in that issue here back in 1992 has served the parties well, and unfortunately, this attack on this award threatens to kind of unravel procedure that was set up to settle.
You don't really think that would be the basis of our decision, do you?
Well, I wouldn't, of course, think that would be the basis.
You have to show us, don't you, how this was arbitrable how the arbiter can be upheld in his decision that it's arbitrable.
Yes, and I can do that, Your Honor. The MOU, I mean, if you read the award enough times, and of course it is not a crystal clear award, but but arbitrators not even required.
The understatement of awards for that.
Arbitrators are not even required to write awards. But if you read it enough, you understand, at least I began to understand what he was doing. The fact is that in 1992, there was an assignment. The assignment was to the American Postal Workers Union. The American Postal Workers Union had no occasion in 1992 to institute a dispute over whether the scanning of the international mail was within the jurisdiction of the American Postal Workers Union or the Mail Handlers Union. And in fact, the Postal Service's own management issued an amendment to the joint inventory confirming that this was primarily, principally, the work of the American...
So where's the language of the contract that the arbitrator draws, from which the arbitrator draws
well,
the essence?
Well, we'll go to the contract. We go to the 1992 MOU, and he says...
Give us the JA page.
Yes, it's JA 100, and then going on to 101. So JA 100 says that effective with the signing of this this memorandum, no new no new disputes will be initiated at the local level by either union challenging the jurisdictional work assignment in any operations as they
What does the last sentence of that page mean?
That
committee decision shall be by mutual agreement of all three parties. What's that referring to?
Well, that means that to resolve a jurisdictional dispute, all three parties have to agree. No bilateral settlements. What was agreed mutually was to refer the jurisdictional dispute for decision by the arbitrator. And that's what the arbitrator was getting at. He says,
So this is the language that the arbitrator draws the essence
well,
of?
Well, more than that. If you go to page 101 in this second paragraph, each party at the local level will be responsible for maintaining an inventory of jurisdictional assignments not in dispute. Well, there is an inventory. That's the proof of where the assignments were or were not in dispute. And the question of scanning on the docks does not appear in the inventory till the Postal Service changed the inventory to add to clarify that this work was the work of the American Postal Workers Union.
But I thought you already conceded the Postal Workers Union had the work at the time of the MOU.
That's right. The APW claims it was disputed by the parties. I must say I have to take...
I thought you said that they had it at the time of the MOU.
The APW, yes, says that it was their work at the time of the MOU and that the inventory amendment confirmed, the Postal Service's inventory amendment confirmed the fact that it was the work of the APW. So why would the APW institute a dispute in 1992? They instituted a dispute later after the Postal Service changed the inventory when a mail handler kept doing the scanning. So then that was a claim of a Crosscraft violation. It was a claim that there was a violation of the APW's established jurisdiction. That, according to the mail handlers and the Postal Service, raised a jurisdictional dispute, and the parties yanked it out of that bilateral procedure, which cannot resolve a jurisdictional dispute, and put it in the RI 399 procedure. So the arbitrator is faced with this question. The parties took it out of the bilateral process, gave it to me to decide a jurisdictional dispute, and then the Postal Service...
What's the basis upon which it would be said that they gave it to him to decide the jurisdictional dispute?
It's the referral.
The parties, and that's based on what?
It's based on the... I will tell you. If Joint Appendix 121 for one of the grievances and Joint Appendix 123 for the other. Not the scheduling letter. This is the decision of the APW and the Postal Service that, as counsel says on the question and answer 3, if any one party thinks there's a jurisdictional dispute, everything has to stop in the bilateral process and it has to go to the trilateral process.
I think it's fair to say the parties gave the question of arbitrability to the arbitrator, but I don't think it's fair to say that the parties gave the merits to the arbitrator.
Well, they gave the question of arbitrability to the arbitrator, and as this court, we're fortunate to have two members of that panel on this panel, decided in the American Postal Workers Union versus Postal Service case and by Judge Edwards.
I almost dissented in that case. Truth be known.
If the award draws...
That wasn't the same issue as this.
It wasn't, but it was close. Because when we look...
Close, is that another term for distinguishable?
I think they're pretty parallel, Chief Judge Santel. Let me explain why. In that case, you could have read that award as being going beyond the jurisdiction of the arbitrator to decide whether a probationary employee had access to the grievance procedure. But there was a way to affirm it, to say that, well, he looked at that, but he looked at other things. In this case, it is clear that the arbitrator says, well, you gave me this case. I look at the inventory. The inventory did not say any union had jurisdiction. The Postal Service affirmed that the APW had jurisdiction and then pulled a fast one, basically, by pulling it out of the bilateral procedure, coming to the RI-399 procedure, and then telling the arbitrator, you don't have jurisdiction to decide this dispute, so it never gets decided. So the arbitrator says, well, that can't be the intention of the parties. That can't be what the parties had in mind, that you could grant jurisdiction, then turn around and take it away on an argument of arbitrability. And he used a very respectable principle of labor arbitration, the continuing violation theory, saying that the union did not have to file a dispute immediately. It could file a dispute because the mail handler on the dock kept doing the work even after the Postal Service decided that that work was actually belonged to the American Postal Workers Union. Well, the arbitrator says, you just can't play fast and loose like that. You can't just send the case to me to decide a jurisdictional dispute and then say, then it's not arbitrable, so it's never decided. And then the Postal Service squirms out of its assignment. The procedure was not meant to work that way.
Let me make sure I understand. That's another way of saying I don't understand. What exactly are you basing your position on that says the three parties all agreed to give this to the arbitrator?
Well, as I said, the two parties sent it. Any one party could send it. Two parties sent it, and then all three parties joined issue on the merits and the arbitrability question, the mail handlers as well. Each party under the agreement had to write a position statement. Each party wrote a position statement that addressed both the merits and arbitrability. And then the issue was given to the arbitrator to decide.
If the arbitrator had said, because the parties have agreed to submit it to me, they've agreed it's arbitrable, so I'm going to proceed directly to the merits, should we overturn a decision like that?
I don't think so, because I think what he was doing, and I'll tell you why, because he was construing the MOU and the Q&As on, there are two Q&As at issue here, one of them about jurisdiction, the other one saying that the parties had to, that if both unions had shared jurisdiction, it should appear as such in the inventory, and it was not in the inventory.
But you're going to the specifics instead of the hypothetical.
The hypothetical is if the arbitrator says, because the parties have agreed to submit the matter to me, I can skip arbitrability and go straight to the merits. Now, suppose the arbitrator had said that.
I think he had to decide arbitrability, and he did decide arbitrability.
Okay.
And I think the district court...
Did he draw the arbitrability from the essence of the agreement?
Excuse me?
Did he draw his decision on arbitrability?
Absolutely. As in the postal workers' case, the 2009 case, he looked at the MOU, he looked at the assignments, he looked at the evidence, he focused on the parties' agreement, and he made a decision. And as this court said, he had a right to be wrong. I actually don't even think he was wrong, but he had a right to be wrong. And that at that point, I think that the judicial review ends. Well, if the court has nothing further, I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. One of the appellants had some time left. You took your chances. You can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll make this brief. I just want to address this one issue about that the counsel for the APW said that this all three parties agreed to submit this question to the arbitrator. They pulled it out and put it into the jurisdictional process. Saying something is a jurisdictional dispute doesn't mean that it's a timely and proper jurisdictional dispute under the terms of the MOU. And if you look at the joint scheduling letter, which is the letter that submitted this case to arbitration, it couldn't have stated more clearly that it says, actually, this letter does not constitute a waiver by either party of any objection on the basis of timeliness or arbitrability. So that question was certainly preserved. The arbitrator, under the terms of the agreement, had to decide that question, had to make that threshold finding that this is a timely and proper grievance under the terms, under the provisions set forth in the MOU. He did not do that here, and therefore his award is due to be vacated on that basis. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Call the next case.